You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, May 17th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history and coordinator at the Latin American Studies at Salem State University. The author of Central America's Forgotten History, Revolution, Violence, and the Roots of Migration, Aviva Chomsky, will be with us. Also on the program today, Israeli warplanes continue to pound Palestinians. Dozens more killed yesterday, including children. Meanwhile, Joe Biden blocks a UN call for a ceasefire for a third time. Some Democratic senators are now getting out ahead of Biden, demanding cessation of hostilities. Over the weekend, Israel destroys a Gaza tower full of media bureaus. Just a coincidence, I'm sure. U.S. Supreme Court takes a case that many think will be the one used to reverse Roe v. Wade. Meanwhile, in Mississippi, their Supreme Court overturns a citizen-passed medical marijuana constitutional amendment. And that child cash benefit that the Biden administration thought they could start by mid-July will, in fact, start in mid-July. Cuomo's sexual harassment accusers have received subpoenas to a grand jury to testify. Key juncture in that investigation. The Ninth Circuit upholds a ruling that Monsanto's Roundup is responsible for cancers. AT&T abandons its entertainment project. Has plans to merge its entertainment properties with Discovery. And lastly, Microsoft board apparently had asked Bill Gates to step down in wake of the alleged affair. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for starting your week off with us. Glad to have you. Also, happy to see Emma Vigeland here today. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello. I am well. How was your weekend, Sam?
My weekend was fine. We'll have more time to talk about this later, but I don't want to brag, but the Pony League team that I assistant coach won for its second week in a row.
Emphasis on assistant.
Well, I don't want to steal any valor.
Right.
So assistant
kind of
coach.
The shadowy figure behind whispering in the head coach's ear.
No, I'm just out there, you know. I do what she tells me, and that's basically it. I you know.
Sure.
I'm the pitcher. Designated pitcher, so that's pretty good. Once you win that game, the whole weekend is good, and it's just a matter of, if you have a kid that age, it's really just a matter of you get the game over, you win the game, and then it's basically just negotiating how much candy the kid wants to eat that weekend, and that's it. So it was good. Meanwhile, the hostilities continue in Israel and in Palestine, particularly the Gaza Strip. The Israeli warplanes have continued to pound Gaza, killing more and more civilians. The essential dynamic that you have to understand that has really, in many respects, always been the case. And, people will argue, what What was the first offense in this skirmish? And I think most reasonable people agree that the first skirmish here was the, essentially the what amounts to an ethnic cleansing of East Jerusalem and of a neighborhood that has where the Israeli government is essentially continuing its latest move of disposition dispossession of Palestinians. They want to cleanse that area of Palestinians in the East Jerusalem. But the one dynamic that has, I think there's no controversy about, is that the Israeli government has the strongest military, you know, by far in the region, has a much greater capacity to kill, particularly civilians for that matter, but really anyone.
And that bears out in the numbers.
Than the Palestinians.
Of dead. And
yes.
Yeah.
It totally bears out in the numbers. But I mean, you don't even, like, you know, if you had asked me randomly 6 months ago if the Israeli government was to engage in war or hostilities or whatever you want to call it with Palestinians in Gaza, Hamas, it doesn't matter. I could tell you that every day those hostilities continue on, there will be a growing gulf between the number of Palestinians dead, civilians, and Israelis. Because that dynamic is blatant and obvious. And so you don't need the numbers to know that that was going to happen, but it's completely consistent with what we know. So the point being, every day these hostilities continue. Any reasonable person knows that means more Palestinian civilians, men, women, and children, will die. And there will be an increasing number, and the rate of those deaths will increase. Never mind the implications long term in terms of infrastructure. The Israelis have an equal ability to damage the infrastructure of people living in Gaza, which has been described as the world's largest open air prison. And so you don't need to know any of the facts. You simply need to know that dynamic and know what's going to happen day to day. So the fact that the Biden administration is standing in the way of the UN issuing a ceasefire, I don't know if Israel would listen to a ceasefire or Hamas would.
But not that they listened to the United Nations before and their creation of the borders that they violate every day.
But it's obviously important enough that the Biden administration feels that we need to stop it.
Yeah.
So there are, it does create pressure. When the Biden administration does that, they know exactly what the implications of that are. That is not a neutral decision. This is very, if a 250-pound guy and a 110-pound guy get into a fight, you know, in the cafeteria, as it were, wherever, and the teachers around there or whoever say, like, oh, we're going to let them fight. They're not just, that's not a neutral decision. That is a decision to allow the 250-pound guy to destroy the 110-pound guy.
And the teacher's handing nunchucks to the 250-pound guy.
Well, that's also, yes, well, that's when you start to bring in the sales of arms. But I raise that dynamic just because here is Fox News attempting to both protect the storyline of Israel killing so many civilians and also be able to make it seem like Joe Biden is somehow not doing enough for Israel.
Absolutely. You know, Israel has been one of our strongest allies in the Middle East forever, and we are theirs. And that is why the Republican Party is pretty much united. Republicans in Congress have been asking Joe Biden to take a firm stance on Israel, but Joe Biden is reluctant to. He has, the White House has announced he's spoken on Saturday to both sides, but for the most part, he has been quiet. He's really not taken a side. And most of Congress has been silent on the fighting. You know, usually by this point in a conflict, there would be a bipartisan resolution passed in the Congress talking about a ceasefire. There has been, the committees haven't even talked about something that would have been automatic.
Like I say, the neutrality is, well, first of all, you're blocking a call for a ceasefire, and you know the implications of that. There has been a $735 million sale of weapons, precision guided weapons to Israel.
But he also sent $735 million in precision guided missiles to Palestine and Hamas, right?
That is not the case, actually.
Oh,
but at
okay.
the very least, they have made it very clear that Israel has the right to defend itself.
Yeah, they've said that over and over and over again, and that's the repeated line, even when confronted with the tens of children that have died in Palestine, the disproportionate number of civilian deaths that have occurred or at the direct hand of the Israeli government, the fact that Israel instigated this conflict by raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque and
Aqsa.
Jesus, I'm picking
You're
up
picking
verbal,
it up
verbal tics from you. So I mean, there's never a discussion about that. But I don't even know what Biden could have done differently, besides coming out draped in an Israeli flag to make Steve Ducey comfortable in this situation, because I've been disgusted by the Biden administration's response every single step of the way.
Well, Ducey would have said at that point that he's desecrating the flag.
Yeah, you're right.
He would have found something.
He's like, why not an American flag? Where
exactly.
does your allegiances lie?
All right. Well, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be shifting focus. We'll be talking to Aviva Chomsky about the now forgotten American history of its role in Central America. And its role in creating this attempts for people to migrate from countries that are that have been basically derailed for decades because of American intervention. We will be right back after this. Folks, we've been shopping online quite a bit. I've talked to you in the past multiple times over the years. Had to teach Mila how to go and look for coupon codes because I wanted to teach her to be, I don't think it's, you know, frugal necessarily, but just as like responsible. If there's like, if it takes you 2 minutes to go and you get a couple,
right.
of, you know, but it's gotten harder and harder over the years to go and search for coupon codes. And then it became super, super easy. How did it become super easy? Because of Honey. It's the free shopping tool that scours the internet for promo codes and applies the best ones and adds it to your cart all automatically. Honey supports over 30,000 stores online, ranging from sites that have tech and gaming products to popular fashion brands, even food delivery. So think about it this way. You're shopping on one of your favorite sites. When you check out, the Honey button drops down. Actually, I don't think that's even true. I think it comes into the side.
Mm-hmm. That's probably depends on your browser.
I think it comes into the side. They got this wrong. And all you have to do is click apply coupons. You wait a few seconds as Honey searches for coupons it can find at that site. If Honey finds a working coupon, you'll watch the prices drop. Honey has found over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. Just over the past, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, I saved a couple of bucks on a new baseball bat for Saul and, frankly, the team. And a donut. Not like a edible donut, but like a donut you put on the bat to put a little extra weight on it. So
right.
when they're, I may have to wait with the kids on the donut. I got a couple bucks off it, but these kids can barely swing a bat, even like a 26-inch bat.
Yeah, I don't know why you jumped to that, but
it's tough to calibrate. Mila has saved a ton over the past year or two. I think she's been using Honey on stuff like makeup and her skin regimen products, et cetera, et cetera. And I have to say, for me, what I actually like about it is, like, even when they don't find anything, they tell you. So you don't have that anxiety that, like, I'm going to purchase this. I guess maybe most people don't have that. And then I'm going to find out later. I could have saved 5%.
No, 7%. No, I know. They scour. They'll say.
Yeah, but it says, like, no, none available.
Yes, I use this.
Okay. Let's not get into a fight about it. If you don't already have Honey, in other words, if you're not like Emma and you don't have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free savings. It's literally free and installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you're going to be doing yourself a solid, supporting this podcast. Like I say, I think you know, I never recommend anything I do not use myself. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. Also, speaking of stuff that I use, as you know, I am not the world's best shopper. I don't particularly like crowds. I don't particularly like stores. I'm not even that savvy when it comes to clothes, frankly. But shopping online is difficult because you don't know if it's going to fit. You don't know if you're actually going to like it when it gets there. Well, Stitch Fix does all the hard work for you. It offers clothing hand-selected by expert stylists for your unique size, your unique style, your unique budget. Every piece is chosen for your fit and your life so you can look and feel your best. Try on pieces at home before you buy. You keep what you love. You return what you don't. They make it super easy. Stitch Fix has free shipping and super easy returns or exchanges. They include a prepaid return envelope is included in your, what they call your fix. There's no subscription required. You pay $20 for a styling fee for each box, which gets credited toward pieces that you keep. There are no hidden fees ever. Stitch Fix has styles and clothing, fits any occasion, women, men, kids. They ship all over the U.S. They're available in the U.K. as well. They got shoes. They got shirts. I am now, like, in the, I've talked in the past about the all the stuff I've gotten. It reintroduced me to five pot. That's the thing I like about it the best. It's like listening to college radio. Like, I'll listen to college radio when I can't, just because I want to be, to exposed to stuff that I wouldn't contemplate listening to. And that's what Stitch Fix does to me too. It, like, I let it take me just outside, slightly out of my comfort zone. I'm not necessarily always getting those clothes, but it's like making me think, like, I got back into the five pocket pants. I didn't know if I would ever do that.
Right.
And my daughter, of course, stole flannel shirt. Exactly. But right now I am looking very, very seriously at the, long sleeve tees.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I am. Even though I know it's not necessarily the season, I'm thinking, like, I like to always, like, go a little bit outside of a season.
Well, it saves you money when you go outside the season.
It does. I don't know if it does it in this instance, but I just am used to doing that. But there's a couple of shirts in here that you probably will be seeing soon on this program as I am eyeing them at the moment. But you check it out. Stitch Fix is a great way if you're like me, where you don't want to go to the stores. You could use a little bit of advice and help. And it's super easy, again, to return. And you can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. At stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. Okay, I want to welcome back to the program Professor of History. She is the coordinator of Latin American Studies at Salem State University, author of her latest, Central America's Forgotten History, Revolution, Violence, and the Roots of Migration. Aviva Chomsky, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on the show. Nice to see you.
You as well. The history of Central America, always, I mean, and we, and I want to talk about the sort of the broader questions of why we tend to forget major chunks of our history in this country. But the specific question of the history of Central America has come back into focus, it seems to me, in particular with the assignment. And I don't really have a sense of how that's going in any way or exactly what they're, what the assignment specifics of it were, of the vice president to to go to Central America and try and figure out how to make things better in, I guess, presumably in Central America, so that people won't feel as desperate to leave those countries. But let's, before we get to sort of the more recent history, will you just like give us a breakdown of the history of the development of that region? These countries did not exist 175 years ago. Just give us the history at that point.
Okay. Well, if you don't mind, I'll be really fast, but I'd actually like to go back even a little bit further. So the Isthmus of Central America was, of course, inhabited by indigenous people until colonized by Spain in the 1500s as a sort of an extension of its colonization of Mexico. And Central America was kind of a peripheral region in the Spanish Empire, meaning that it didn't have the fantastic wealth that Mexico and Peru had. It was kind of like a forgotten backwater of the Spanish Empire. So Central America, that's all I'm going to say about the long history. But the Central America became independent as part of Mexico because it was part of the viceroyalty of New Spain. So the governing authorities and elites, the political structure was centered in what's now Mexico City. And then over the course of the 19th century, underwent a series of revolutions and civil wars during which the five countries of what we know of as Central America broke off by the middle of the 19th century. Civil wars continued, and it's not really until late in the 19th century that the kind of the contemporary order of those countries, the states, are actually established. And they're established by different groups of elites, many of them European immigrants, not in the indigenous people of the country. And that's something important to remember about the revolutions there, that like most of the rest of Latin America and like the United States, those wars of independence did not actually bring independence for the victims of colonization. They brought independence for a group of elites who established countries in their own interest, not really in the interest of Native Americans and African Americans and the people who had been colonized.
I want to get to those specifics of those interests, but can we talk about just going back a little bit, like to the Black legend? And the concept of like the different types of the different ways in which colonization took place that ends up having implications down the road.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, the European colonial enterprise began with Spain, followed by Portugal back in 1492. And Spain being the first grabbed the most lucrative and valuable territories that it found. And it was particularly interested in areas that had large indigenous populations that could be coerced into labor and in areas that had mineral resources. This is a very familiar theme in Central American history, so you can hold on to it as I go on. The British and the French and the Dutch and the Danish got into the game late, the Northern European countries. And they were economically backward latecomers. And all of the best colonial territories in the Americas had already been claimed by Spain and Portugal. So they kind of got the leftovers, Britain, especially Britain and France, but also the Netherlands and Denmark. And the leftovers meant North America and many of the Caribbean islands, which had much smaller indigenous populations. So they didn't have a labor force able to be coerced. And they didn't have obvious deposits of mineral resources that the Europeans could take. Now, those Northern Europeans also had to justify their colonial enterprises. And one of the ways they did it is through what you mentioned, the Black Legend, that is to promote, and they were also at war with Catholic Spain. Within Europe, there were a lot of things going on. But as part of their like push for European and global supremacy, they promoted the idea that the Spaniards were like the really evil colonizers, and they went around killing people and just being self-interested. Whereas they, the Northern European Protestant colonizers, were the good colonizers. So, you know, we have this image of the Spanish conquistador. We never talk about Northern European conquistadors. We even use the word in Spanish, and that's part of how the Black Legend has come down to us, that they were only in it to make money, whereas Northern Europeans just wanted freedom and all kinds of good things for themselves. They didn't want to oppress anybody. If you look at the colonial projects that they implemented, you actually find that those cultural differences, Catholic versus Protestant, Northern versus Southern, don't make a whole lot of difference. What made the most difference was timing and the areas that they got. But where those Northern Europeans discovered economic potential beyond mineral resources, especially in the production of sugar, tobacco, cotton, other plantation crops, they implemented an economic system just as exploitative and oppressive as the Spaniards did in their territories. It wasn't because those New England colonists weren't just better people than the Spanish conquistadors. There were just no resources for them to exploit, so they had to farm.
And therefore, they needed to import their labor, essentially, in the form of slaves.
Yes, where there were resources to be exploited, the Northern Europeans were just as happy to enslave people, or even happier to enslave people than the Spaniards were.
How much does religion play into that? I mean, you mentioned the cultural differences perhaps between the Catholics and the Protestants, but how much, and I'm not asking for like a theological response as much as how much did their own sort of mythology that they were trying to create rely on their projection of what supposedly their religious values were? Does that make sense, that question?
Yeah. I mean, the Protestant Northern Europeans certainly considered themselves superior. They considered their religion superior. This slowly started to morph into more of a racial idea of their own superiority over Southern Europeans. But what I'm trying to argue in the book and here is that the cultural differences were really quite minimal, that it was more the way they tried to use their religious or supposed racial or whatever differences to promote themselves as a superior people. So they said, we're better, we're racially better, we're religiously better. But in fact, they didn't really act that differently. And British colonists proved just as genocidal against the native populations in the areas that they conquered and colonized, especially when there were resources available, as did the Spaniards. So I don't think that we can look at cultural differences in modes of colonization. It had to do with timing, demography, and geography.
All right, fair enough. And methodology, like you say, it was more or less the same. I mean, was the did those factors, the existence of indigenous people in Central America, Did the existence of the indigenous people change, and the reliance that the Southern Europeans had on their labor, did that change their methodology in any way, insofar as, like, did they, when they had to coerce, was their approach really any, obviously they didn't have to import, but because people were already there and they were, you know, did their approach, was it any different than the way that, I guess, Northern Europeans were coercing, you know, labor at that point?
Well, so the Spaniards and the Portuguese, but I'll focus on the Spaniards, because remember, the Portuguese also did not encounter the large sedentary empires where it was really, they could establish those coercive labor systems with the indigenous people. So the Spanish also became importers of enslaved people from Africa, just like the British. Again, it's not really a cultural difference. It's more structural that led to these different outcomes. But in the Spanish territories, they really used two different systems, one for Africans and one for indigenous people. There was enslavement of indigenous people in North America by the British and in Brazil by the Portuguese, but simply because of numbers and because of forms of social organization. That is, it's a lot harder to develop systems of mass enslavement when you don't have a large sedentary population that's already immersed in a system of taxation and forced labor to an empire. So the Spaniards had the good luck that the Aztecs and the Incas set up these systems before they even got there, so they could just kind of take them over. So the Spaniards had two separate systems, and they also used African slavery, the Spaniards, especially in areas where they didn't have ready access to indigenous labor, but where they discovered resources. So in places like Colombia, where they discover gold, and they don't have these large indigenous populations to coerce, they also bring in African slaves. But for the indigenous people, they used not direct enslavement, but a system called encomienda, which was sort of a where they relied on indigenous social structures and a lot of the subsistence economy that the indigenous people already had. And it was more like a labor draft kind of system.
Okay, and so lastly, was when the Spanish and Portuguese, and I imagine, I mean, we could ask this for the Northern Europeans as well. Was the resources that they were extracting, was that a function of the state? Or let's say the merchant class. I mean, what was driving that extraction in terms of, like, the specifics that they were extracting?
Well, that also changed over time, but it's hard to even draw a real distinction between the state and the merchant class because, you know, the Spanish empires were established on a direct system of mercantilism. The British and the Dutch created these sort of state companies, the Dutch East India Company, the Dutch West India Company, the British East India Company, the British West India Company, which were sort of public-private collaborations. But just going back to Central America, where you really see in the 19th century that the state is the product of the elite classes and their economic project. So it's really hard to separate the economic powers from the political powers because they're just one and the same.
And was there a distinction between, I guess, sort of the, I don't know if you say geopolitics relative to that time, but the, you know, how much was directed by just pure extraction, and how much was there, like, I guess, planning to, oh, we want this beachhead because ultimately we're going, we're not going to be able to satiate our desire for extraction here. We're also going to want to go over there. And so we're going to want this beachhead here. I mean, how much of it was sort of like this geopolitical military planning involved in that?
Well, you see that most clearly in the Caribbean. And so, you know, why were the Spanish willing to give up Caribbean islands to the British and the French? Why were they, why didn't they impose the kind of military control? Mostly because of the lack of resources there. So for the Spanish, the Caribbean was important for geostrategic reasons. It was their shipping lanes. So they wanted to make sure they could control the shipping, but they were less interested in territorial control. They did keep control of the three largest islands, Puerto Rico, Cuba, and at least half of Hispaniola, although the French took the other half. That's today Haiti and the Dominican Republic. But really, desire for land and dreams of profit motivated the territorial expansion as they went on. And you can see this in both North America and Central South America. So, you know, the Spain and Portugal wanted to establish the kind of claims you're talking about very early on and made a deal with the Pope. And again, like church, state, and merchant elites are, again, you can't even really separate them. But the Treaty of Tordesillas was established by the Vatican that basically divided the Americas between Spain and Portugal and kind of drew a line that ended up being not exactly, but the basis for the border between the Portuguese Empire, which is today Brazil, and on the eastern coast, and the Spanish territories on the west. So Spain claimed all of it. And this was somewhat different from in North America. The other thing is that the Americas were basically the center of Spain's empire, whereas for the Northern Europeans, they had a much more global vision. So they were taking colonies by the 1600s, 1700s, not just in the Americas, but in Asia, in Africa. They were in charge of the slave trade. So the Americas were were less lucrative and a smaller piece of their bigger imperial. And that's why, in a sense, the British were not willing to financially support the colonizers, the British colonizers, desires for territorial expansion in North America. And that was one of the causes of the American Revolution, was the British saying, you know what, you've got to stop this. We're not going to keep pouring resources into your territorial expansion here.
Well, I wanted to ask too, just as we move into the later centuries, right, the 19th century, the 1800s, when a lot of these things come to a head, I was not aware of this, but the population in Central America just was completely decimated. I mean, I'd heard, you know, about, of course, the role of disease and the violence and what have you, but it was incredibly dramatic, that population decrease. Can you talk about the colonial cause in that amount of mass death?
So this is actually true not only in Central America, but of the native populations everywhere in the Americas. We have about a 90% population decline. You know, the term decline is a little undramatic, a demographic catastrophe. And it's due to a combination of factors. The Black legend, that is the history and mythology promoted by the British, is, oh, look, the Spanish did this because they're so cruel and terrible. They did it deliberately. But it wasn't exactly deliberate. And in fact, in the British territories, pretty much the same thing happened. Disease definitely played a huge role. And even though there certainly was warfare and deliberate attempts at genocide, but in fact, the Spanish also had an interest in keeping the population alive because it was their source of taxation and labor force. Like, what's the point of colonizing people if they aren't there to be exploited? And so parts of the causes of the demographic collapse definitely had to do with European diseases. And if you think about what's happening in Europe in the centuries preceding colonization, you have this series of plagues and Black Death and major demographic disasters in Europe of infectious diseases due to the sort of circuit, the Afro-Eurasian circuit that moved pathogens around that area, but kept the Americas protected from those pathogens. So what happens when the Europeans arrive is all the pathogens come at once, and the native populations are assaulted by wave after wave of disease. In the context of colonization that is enslaving, uprooting, displacing, destroying native economic systems, agricultural systems, so that it's like a perfect storm of factors that lead to population decline. And, you know, you can think about it a little bit in the comparison to today's pandemic. That is, the pathogen doesn't discriminate, but the circumstances discriminate so that the pathogen doesn't affect every population equally. It affects poor people, people of color, people in the third world, much more than people who are able to protect themselves, even in the case of a pathogen like this one, where, you know, until the development of the vaccine, the science really didn't have a very effective treatment or cure for it. So it's not just access to advanced medical care. It's the whole social context that makes some people more vulnerable than others. So people who are in the process of being uprooted, dispossessed, and colonized are at their most vulnerable.
So let's jump forward to this shift in dynamic where the United States ends up becoming the primary colonizing force in the region. When does that start to take shape? And Europe's, I guess, influence or interests wane on some level?
So that starts to take place in the 19th century. And, you know, we usually use the term neo-colonialism to refer to these sort of post-colonial situations where the Latin American countries are theoretically, politically independent. They're no longer colonies governed by an outside place, in this case, Spain. And yet they remain economically, politically, militarily subject to more powerful outside countries that impose their will on them, not through direct governance, but through a whole slew of economic institutions, trade regulations, military interventions, et cetera. But I think also just to understand how the United States became the sort of neo-colonial power in Latin America, it's also important to go back to what I was saying about U.S. independence, how it was the United States was a settler colonial colony, and it was in fact the colonizers, that is the British and their descendants who were colonizing, who fought for and declared independence. And they fought for and declared independence in part to expand their colonial project. So like even the language we use makes it hard for us to understand this because we don't call them colonizers. We call them colonists as if they were, I don't know, they weren't colonizing, but obviously they were colonizing. And territorial expansion was one of the main goals of American independence. That is, the British were no longer promoting or even willing to support territorial expansion. The British drew a line. They made treaties with the Native Americans. They said, okay, this is it. This is all you're getting from us. So the colonizers said, okay, we're going to go it alone if the British won't let us do it. So independence is followed immediately by territorial expansion, starting in the 1790s and continuing nonstop. And Central America's caught in this vortex. That is, it's really with the gold rush in California that Central America first enters the U.S. sort of colonizing sphere. And of course, we call it the gold rush. We just avoid the word colonialism when everything we talk about, you know, manifest destiny, territorial expansion. But, colonialism and genocide are what are going on here. The 19th century was a century of permanent warfare against the native populations of North America in the interests of colonization.
It's interesting, but it just occurs to me that the American Revolution is sort of like The analogy that I think is just that movie Welcome to the Dollhouse, which is also just an incredibly old, remote analogy. But where you had this girl in middle school was getting picked on by somebody. And so she came home and she started picking on her little brother, I think it was, or something. And on some level, that's what was going on. We had colonizers here who were extracting resources from the indigenous people, but because the extraction was happening, they were just the middle person for the extraction. There was more they overthrew the sort of colonizing relationship they had with England at that point and said, we're just going to hold on to the resources that we're extracting from the indigenous people instead of passing it up the ladder, as it were. So with that said, and maybe I'm going back just a little bit, but maybe it's not, and maybe it's not relevant. But when the elites carved up Central America into the countries that we see today, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Was there anything beyond sort of like the idiosyncrasies of what those elites had? Maybe I am interested in iron, and so this is mineral is here, or I have, you know, a good trading partner for this crop or something like that, so I want this territory. Was there anything beyond those sort of immediate desires of whatever I'm situated to extract from this this area, and that's where are we drawing the lines? Is there anything else that has broader implications that we should know of as we get into this era where the United States influences and begins to extract from that area?
Well, one thing that I would mention is Atlantic versus Pacific. That is, the Atlantic coast of Central America, the Caribbean coast of Central America, the East coast of Central America, and you know, all of this terminology is used to describe it, but you can kind of picture it, this isthmus, was very, very separate from the Spanish colonial project. It was much more closely connected to the British and Caribbean colonial projects. So the indigenous populations of the Central American countries were primarily Pacific facing. And you can also imagine this kind of mountain range going up the middle of the isthmus. So in this fertile volcanic mountainous region and along the eastern, the western tropical coast is where most of the indigenous people lived. And that's where the Spanish established their colonial institutions of control. The eastern portion of the country was much more lightly populated. The indigenous people there had historically been connected to the indigenous people of the Caribbean. It also became a haven for escaped slaves from the Caribbean. And it was mostly the British who had political and economic control there, if not direct colonial ownership of the territories. So the British established the Mosquito Kingdom in Nicaragua. They transported escaped slaves to the coasts of Honduras. So that's one sort of set of divisions to keep in mind. Now, this becomes very important in the 19th century in terms of the U.S. getting involved, because the British Caribbean sees the beginnings of a banana industry based on the eastern coast of the United States in Boston and New Orleans that quickly takes over those territories in eastern Central America. So there's a number of different companies involved. The most notorious and the one that ended up swallowing most of the others is the United Fruit Company, that becomes the major landowner and essentially a kind of state within a state along the Atlantic coast. And this is especially true in Costa Rica, Guatemala, Honduras, where there's a large coastline that it's rainforest, basically completely deforested and turned over to these gigantic banana plantations.
And this is the beginning of a relationship that continues on for, I don't know, decades at this at that point. And so how much of that dynamic was, let me ask the same question that was less relevant in maybe the 18th century than it might be in the 19th century and into the 20th century. How much of this, how much of this extraction was a function of the mercantile or corporate class at that point, and how much of it was a function of the state wanting some type of strategic, you know, I don't know, beachhead, I guess. I mean, does it, is there really, or is it, you know, the fact is it's not, wasn't terribly that different. The U.S. military and Navy was deployed as needed on behalf of the United Fruit Company, period, end of story. It really isn't until, like, I don't know, the Cuban Missile Crisis that, you know, there's even like a, I don't know if you can make a serious argument for some type of disconnect there, but at least that there's a broader narrative that, like, hey, this is really about, you know, we don't want missiles there, as opposed to like, we're everything really, we can't even pretend that this isn't anything other than protecting our corporate interests.
Well, you remember dollar diplomacy at the beginning of the 20th century? The idea is that the sword follows the dollar. And I think it's a really good concept for understanding U.S. interventions in the Caribbean and Central America. That is, if corporate interests can take care of themselves, so much the better. But, you know, according to Theodore Roosevelt, the Roosevelt corollary at the beginning of the 20th century, if our investments, our national interest is put into danger, then our military is going to be there to support them. And that's why at the beginning of the 20th century, we see these sort of repeated, you know, after the Spanish-American War, repeated U.S. military landings, interventions in the Caribbean and Central America, sometimes leading, sometimes short-lived just to get rid of one government and put in another one, sometimes long-lived occupations like that of Nicaragua from 1912 to 1933, you know, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, repeated interventions in Cuba. Shorter-lived interventions in Honduras to protect or create this favorable investment climate. Before we just get stuck on bananas, though, I wanted to mention sort of the other part of the 19th century economic consolidation of Central America, which is coffee. And if bananas are on the eastern coast, coffee is on the Central Highlands mountains and down towards the Pacific coast. So Central American elites themselves are not so involved with the banana economy. That's kind of a separate thing going on the coast. There's not even any roads between the eastern coast and the central areas of the country. But really the heartland of the states is the coffee economy. And there's a lot of European immigration. Just like the United States, there's this racial whitening project going on where Central American elites, like U.S. elites, want to make sure they keep the right racial balance in their country, and they want to do that by importing white immigrants. So there's a lot of immigration. Germans control the coffee economy, German immigrants in Guatemala. There's French and German immigrants in El Salvador. So the Spanish descended elites become more of a mixed European descended elites, not so much in Nicaragua, but definitely in Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras.
Okay, so so we have this dynamic, and where does just jumping ahead a little bit, because I know you have some limited time. Where do we reach that point? Particularly, I mean, it's probably different with all these countries, although it's a similar era, it seems to me, where our final intervention or the one that really sort of made it hard to recover from. I mean, does this make sense? I mean, I worked for a company that had like four different bankruptcies, and I point to, like, you know what? Even after the fourth one, we could have done it. It was the fifth one that really made it impossible to recover from, at least for an extended period of time. Where is that with, and I imagine it's different depending on the country, but not, but in terms of era, it's more or less in the 80s, isn't it, on some level?
Well, you know, when you were saying that, I was trying to think. So I have two to, one would be the Guatemalan intervention in 1954, which is sort of the first Cold War intervention. Where anti-communism, so I mean, is like the way it's sold to the U.S. population. But in many ways, I think the Guatemala, and it overthrows a democratically elected government. You know, it's this clear statement that we don't care at all about democracy. All we care about is protecting the financial interests of elites. But then the Nicaraguan intervention in 1979, I would say, is sort of a direct, counterpart to the Guatemalan intervention in 54, with, you know, the Bay of Pigs kind of in between to tie them together, saying that we have an economic model that we want for Central America and the Caribbean. It relies on a favorable investment climate for U.S. businesses, and anybody who tries to diverge from that, we're going to make sure they get overthrown.
And so we're like, what at that point, do we shift the way in which we operate there? I mean, do we just basically say like we have created this trajectory, and so now we don't have to have as direct of a of an involvement? We've just set it up in such a way that like we know where this goes, and we can sort of influence it from 20,000 feet as opposed to having to be on the ground?
Well, I would say that the peace treaties of the 1990s sort of established that. However, let's not forget that the United States also supported a coup in Honduras in 2009. Right. When the democratically elected president of Honduras threatened to shift towards a somewhat different economic model that prioritized the interests of the poor of his own country over the interests of foreign investors. But certainly the economic model that the United States was able to impose, the United States, you know, along with the international financial institutions, it basically controls, like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and through the use of trade agreements like Reagan's Caribbean Basin Initiative, updated in 2005 with CAFTA, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, which is kind of modeled on NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement with Mexico in 1994, that basically lay down those rules and obligate Central America's governments to follow those rules. And one of the biggest rules is anything that threatens the profits of foreign investors is not allowed. Like, that's basically written right into all of those agreements and the conditions on the loans from the international financial institutions. And all of these countries are heavily indebted. It's another kind of aspect of neocolonialism. Being indebted, at the early part of the century, it was the United States who directly took over those debts and took over the economic decision-making for the governments. Now it's the international financial institutions under the auspices of the United States rather than the U.S. directly.
All right. If we could, we got to take just a quick break, and then we'll come back in a couple minutes and wrap this up. We'll be right back in just a moment. Okay, that's our quick break. So with that said, so we have these trade agreements that were made, like CAFTA, you know, in NAFTA. Was this the innovation of sort of like the codifying a mechanism to make sure that foreign investments have a transcendent sort of extra legality, if you will, I guess. And now we tried to roll that out with the TPP. I mean, is that where that innovation came from, essentially?
Absolutely. The creation of, and this is basically a post-World War II phenomenon, but the creation of these international institutions that, you know, supposedly are autonomous, but are basically under the control of those who fund them, which is the United States. The post-1990s economic model that the United States has for Central America continues with this, pro-foreign investment, basically extractivist model that we've been talking about for 500 years. And this is why, you know, Eduardo Galeano titled his book, Open Veins of Latin America, Five Centuries of the Pillage of a Continent. It was really widely read in Central America, everywhere in Latin America. Currently that focuses especially on the maquiladora sector, that is the outsourcing of labor-intensive portions of the U.S. productive process to third world countries. And so CAFTA sets up the mechanisms for that and led to a huge explosion of free trade zones, enterprise zones, where these maquiladora factories can operate outside of the legal structures of the country financial industrial paradises and avoid having to deal with things like safety regulations and environmental regulations and minimum wages and things they have to deal with in the United States. It has to do with mineral and energy extraction. So a huge boom in the mining and energy sectors. It has to do with tourism that is, again, under the auspices of foreign companies, big all-inclusive resorts, hotel chains, airline companies, to basically take lands out of the hands of subsistence peasants and put them into large corporations that are going to use them to sell to rich consumers from the United States and Europe.
Well, that is the story of extraction of United States extraction from these countries. We're going to say goodbye to our Peacock viewers for the moment. We will be back tomorrow. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And if I could ask you just one more question for those of our non-Peacock viewers who are sticking around. So with this dynamic, right, where we have developed essentially the uniform of the extractors has changed, where it's just sort of like lawyers now who are setting that system up. And the country's the situation on the ground is largely irrelevant to the interests of the United States as long as these corporate interests are protected. And certainly, if I'm a a general in one of these countries, if I'm a kingpin, I have a fairly easy relationship with these corporations. You give me a little bit of protection, I protect you, and some level I protect you locally, and you protect me from 40,000 feet type of perspective, so that we don't have U.S. warplanes come in and take us out or whatever it is. How is that not intractable? How do we in this country, how can we actually, and then ultimately what happens is that recipe creates misery in these countries in the form of either joblessness or violence or a combination of both. That violence can be narco related, or it can be just simply, right wing death squad related. Or maybe there's not. Maybe that's a difference without a distinction. But how do we break that? So we started by saying Joe Biden sent down Kamala Harris, presumably to deal with these issues. Let's say they really wanted to. Joe Biden unplugged all the phones that lead to whatever massive corporate interest, mining interest, commodities interest, and just said, I'm not even listening to you guys anymore. This is what we're going to do. What would that look like?
Both Biden and Harris have talked about getting at the root causes, but I think they have a very shallow vision of what root means, because, you know, they start by talking about the right things: poverty, violence, corruption, drought, hurricanes, climate change. But what they fail to ask is, what's the root of those things? That is, they think they can change them without understanding what the root of those things is. So, you know, if you look at Central America's history, and even Central America today, there's no shortage of grassroots popular movements and organizations that have tried to promote a very different kind of economic model. Sometimes those have succeeded. They have carried out revolutions. Sometimes they've succeeded in taking state power, as in Nicaragua in 1979. Sometimes they've been elected into office, as in Guatemala, 1950s. Chile, 1970s, if you want to go a little beyond. But those popular movements promoting a very different vision of what economic development is, a vision based on the rights of the poor, a vision based on food sovereignty, a vision based on protecting land, water, and air, a vision based on redistribution of the country's resources away from foreign corporations and into the hands of local populations. That is, it's been tried again and again, and there's still everywhere in Central America movements fighting for this. So it's not that there's a shortage of ideas. It's just that there's a shortage of will on the part of the United States to allow these things to happen.
So in other words, it's not even that the United States needs to do something active, or I should say, there's no one thing that the United States needs to do other than provide for space, other than not interfere on some level, right?
At this point, I would say that we actually owe huge reparations to the poor people of Central America. So, I mean, if the United States really wants to do something, like, climate change is a major factor in what's happening in Central America now, in terms of people's ability to survive on the land. So what is the cause of climate change? We are the cause of climate change, right? Our emissions are the major cause of climate change in the world. So if we want to do something, there's a lot that we can do right here. You know, it may not seem so instantaneous. But the other thing is that this economic model that we've imposed on Central America, you know, we claim we want to stop migration, but it's an economic model that's utterly dependent on migration. Our economy is dependent on cheap Central American labor, cheap immigrant labor, undocumented immigrant labor, and Central America's economies are dependent on remittances. So this low-wage model that we have imposed on Central America can't exist without the remittances of people who are working sub-minimum wage jobs in the United States. So it's a big, huge tangle, and we are at the center of it. So, I mean, I would say both allowing experiments to take place in Central America, but also I do think that the concept of reparations is very relevant here.
We got to wait for those experiments to take hold before we start doing like direct reparations, yes or no? I mean, how would we, like, where?
So,
like,
so one way of doing reparations would be to pay immigrant workers better.
Right.
Okay. Like,
that would be a way of doing reparations.
And debt forgiveness. And
debt forgiveness absolutely is a key aspect of the kind of reparations that need to be done. Third world debt should be wiped out.
And maybe we shouldn't weigh in when there is a supposed, we shouldn't be necessarily the arbiter of what's a coup and not a coup, it seems, based upon our recent history in that respect. But do you see any signs that the Biden administration is making those efforts? I mean, how much do you think that they, like, know what they're talking about is just sort of like, we have limitations. We can't really get to the root of the matter, but we'll get to the second order of these things because that'll give us a lot of work to do that won't necessarily cut into the interests of the people who, you know, we can't cut into.
So I actually think that the Biden administration's primary political interests are domestic. He does have a set of domestic reform priorities that he actually wants to implement. And some of those are pretty amazing. But he is very much a middle of the roader and a party man. So he definitely is already thinking towards his 2024 campaign, and he's thinking about the 2022 midterms. He is thinking about keeping this Democratic coalition, like keeping the left out of the Democratic coalition. And for him, foreign policy is basically about appeasing the center and the right. So like he may say nice things, but he's also saying some pretty terrible things in terms of foreign policy in general. And, you know, I really think that in terms of Central America, he wants to protect his right flank with respect to border issues. That is, he sees migration as a political weakness for him. So he wants to both appease the left by saying, oh, we're going after root causes, and appease the right by saying, we're going to stop immigration. But if you look at the kind of aid that he's proposing for Central America, he talks about security and prosperity. And so far, all of the aid has been conditioned on anti-migration militarization. So they're going to help by sending DHS personnel to patrol Guatemala's southern border. That's what kind of aid we're trying to give Central America.
Right. That's the 21st century border that they talk about, which is like basically like, oh, yeah, it's a border that happens to be 100, 200, 500, 1,000 miles away from our actual border. And I would also argue that explanation you give in terms of his domestic interest versus his foreign policy is essentially chum for his right flank is also what we're seeing today in regards to Israel-Palestine.
Absolutely.
Aviva Chomsky, thank you so much for your time today. The book is Central America's Forgotten History. We didn't have time to talk about that concept of forgetting history, so I would love to have you back and have that conversation just about the tendency of why we forget history as a society and how important it is to really bad projects. It seems to me to do so. The book is America's Forgotten, Central America's Forgotten History, Revolution, Violence, and the Roots of Migration. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks. We've already said goodbye to our peacock people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're just going to head into the fun half of the program.
Short for peacock people is just people.
Or peeps.
Well.
No? I don't know what you're getting at with that.
Peaks and peeps.
Yeah. I don't know. You're being a little cryptic about that.
I just thought it sucked.
What did?
Peeps.
Okay. Fair enough. There you go. All right. Maybe you could be a little more cryptic about that. Folks, we're going to head into the fun half. And just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. We've had some great interviews over the past week.
Oh, yeah.
And a half. Yeah. I don't know why I just, you know, we've had some great interviews over the past, I don't know, 12 years. But over the past week and a half, it's been, I'm just, because my daughter said to me the other day, she's like, hey, will you keep me updated on politics?
Yeah.
I was like, sure.
This is a big week for that. I've had friends that have shared like Left Reckoning, for instance, that have never shared it before because of the, I think, urgency of the news.
Bella Hadid. First of all, I just saw on the stream, when I dipped out, we switched. So now we're looking in the wrong way.
Oh, okay.
We'll fix it. Okay. Thank you. And secondly, Bella Hadid put like a tweet of mine on her Instagram story. Do you know who that is?
No.
She's a big, and she shared Michael's video is being shared by all of these celebrities about Israel Palestine.
Oh yeah, no,
Gigi Hadid shared Michael's on her Instagram to 66 million people.
Wow. Yeah. She's they're two sisters who are supermodels, and they're like the biggest two, three supermodels in the world.
I never heard of her.
They're very pretty.
Are they Palestinian? Or
I know that their father is, I believe, Muslim. I don't think they are Palestinian, but I'm not sure.
Wasn't the Michael's clip originally shared by a big musician?
Yeah, Halsey.
Yeah. But like, I mean, to that point, though, it's just,
I'm so old.
It's becoming just so, to what you were saying, it's becoming, you know, undeniable. And the fact that there's so many celebrities behind this is incredibly encouraging, honestly. At least in terms of just swaying public opinion.
Yeah, there definitely feels like there is a.
Oh, he is Palestinian. They are Palestinian.
A change in public opinion. There's just no doubt about it. It just, I mean, that's, you know, someone, you know, knocked on me in the fun half the other day about saying that, you know, Twitter looks different. But that's basically, you know, I think indicative in this instance, anyways, of what's going on broader social media and just sort of popular culture, I guess, is a way of saying that. But my point was that Milo had said, like, you know, I want to get caught up on the news and this and that. And I just thought, like, oh, well, you know what? Listen to Aviva Chomsky and you'll have the context in which to understand our immigration issues and what's happening with this hemisphere. Listen to, you know, Eckhart and I can't even remember his name that we had 2 days ago now.
Please, me neither.
Daniel
Levy. And you get, like, you know, I think Levy gives a good, you know, Noor Erekat has a good sense of the history and sort of like the I think she really expressed, in my mind, a modern perspective and this sort of like ongoing dynamic. Levy is a guy who I think still, as a diplomat on some level, has a specific target in mind with his perspective,
his speech, yeah,
in his comments. And
I'm still just like flummoxed. I mean, I had these conversations over the weekend with some, you know, some people, and like, no matter if you're a liberal in this country, in some ways, there's just still this blind spot.
Daniel Levy is a good person for
my friend was like, I don't even want to talk about it with you. Like, she's like, it's too personal for me. I'm like, okay.
I felt like that's why that conversation was so good, is that you could share that with someone who has the sort of, you know, personal connection to, emotional connection to Israel.
Yes.
Right. I mean, but we'll see. We'll see if I can make headway.
You send them Levy, and then after 2 weeks and they sit with that, then you send them the Noor Erekat interview. That's
Well, I'm not going to lead with Nora.
That's the way that it works there.
Yeah.
I guess I don't know what the point of that is, except for if you want to support these type of interviews, become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show, and then we give you extra content just about every day. Just about every day. I'm sure there's some days that we don't, but for just about. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Hey, folks, the Discord exploding. Over 3,000 members to our Discord now, majoritydiscord.com. It's a great place. You know, we have audiences now on multiple platforms: audio, podcast apps, YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, Twitter, Odyssey or something, and a bunch of others. And
Odyssey or something.
Yeah, or something. There's something else too, I'm sure. I don't even know what it is. But
don't take too long trying to track that one down.
Yeah, I wouldn't spend too much time on that one. But and after the show, everybody in their specific chat forums, but after the show, you want to keep the conversation alive, go to themajoritydiscord.com. Check it out. Also, AM Quickie every morning, 6-7 minutes of your headline news. That's also a good thing to, if you want to start to like, if you're, you know, people ask me like, how can I get my mom or my kid or my friend into a lefter perspective? That's a great gateway, because we try and develop it for sort of like normies, and it's just a slight corrective mm-hmm. on the news in terms of like what deserves coverage and what doesn't, and because you understand, in every circumstance, everybody, us, anybody else you watch or read, any periodicals, whatever it is, there are editorial decisions that are made before any words come out of anybody's mouth or any words are written. And just by nature of what you're covering, you are shaping your content. So, you know, if you're focused on like, there's, you know, right wing oppression of speech on campuses in the, you know, and that's like, you're dedicating, obviously, maybe it's a story for some people, but I mean, to dedicate an extensive amount of coverage to that indicates, you know, to a certain extent, what your political agenda is. Unless you're just like a longtime reporter of, I fell in love with that college newspaper beat and I couldn't ever let go of it. Right. And, you know, but I haven't met that person. Also, don't forget, I think it's happening, right? Arn's show has started. What did he call that? The commissioner? Was that what it was? Check out Nomi's channel today at 3 p.m. See Arn Chaudhry's show. I can't remember what he titled it. I don't even think he told us.
I don't know.
3 p.m. YouTube.com/...
The committee program.
Committee program. Committee program.
The commissioner.
I don't know what I got the commissioner from. I think I just got like, you know, doing baseball stuff. It's the committee.
Right.
Check it out today, 3 p.m. on Nomi's channel, YouTube.com/The Noma Keys Show. Also, don't forget, Matt Leck has like multiple streams going on at any given time. Isn't that right, Matt?
Yeah. So last Thursday, we had Matt Huber on to talk about his Jackman piece, Rich People Are Fueling the Climate Catastrophe. And basically, he helped us learn how to blame the rich people the right way for climate change. Also, tonight on the Literary Hangover Twitch stream, I will be probably playing mostly Rocket League, maybe some Resident Evil, but I can't play Resident Evil on the stream because it can't get scared when I'm streaming for some reason. The suspense is just gone. But anyway, tonight, probably 11, twitch.tv/literary hangover.
All right. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
first post-coital scene with a woman.
I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is gibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way!
Unbelievable.
This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.